From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with award-winning Vermont poet Daniel Lusk, whose most recent books are The Shower Scene from Hamlet and The Vermeer Suite, about which I interviewed him before a live audience in 2015. Today's interview is about an earlier collection of Daniel's, which is called Kin. Other books by Daniel Lusk include Lake Studies, Meditations on Lake Champlain, The Inland Sea, Reflections, Kissing the Ground, and Girls I Never Married, among others. In the interview you're about to hear, I spoke with Daniel Lusk in his home in 2013, and I began by asking him about the unattributed epigraph at the beginning of his book, Kin. It's actually a line that he himself wrote, and I asked that he start by reading that. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
What will it mean to my grandchildren that I fell north or west, that I sang this or that, if they do not know what it meant that silence became my religion?
Thank you. So, is that a poem?
No, it was meant to be the epigraph for the book. I am not close to my family, and so I don't know my grandchildren except for the ones that were Angela's grandchildren as well. So I feel at some great distance from that part of my family.
Mm.
And also because I felt for a long time that my children even don't know who I am, who I became, because they were gone from my life early. So that distance has meant something to me. And I think there's a tone of friends, readers have told me, there's a sense of regret in my work. And I think that's a great part of where that comes from.
Let's see. Is this somewhat like a dedication as well?
What I was trying to do was to establish the tone of the book for readers, so that they would understand very quickly that it's not just about the animals and birds.
Right. Okay. Now that I'm gonna, if I may, read. You have a little preface at the front of the book, and at the end of the first paragraph, you write, "The poems in this collection celebrate the continuing presence in our local wilds of animals, birds, and other creatures with whom we shared our lives." And there's a much longer preface than that, but I thought that encapsulated something nicely that we could just talk a little bit about before we get into the actual poems. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and how you came to put the collection together.
I knew, living where we did, when we began to be visited by not only deer, which are common enough, but animals that I had not seen before, bears, bobcats, moose, porcupines, raccoons, foxes, there was something about my sense that our cohabiting with these creatures, whose land it was, that I was the interloper, and I was going to be writing about how a person like me, who spent his life trying to become a certain kind of poet, a meditative person, could relate to these creatures. And that's what the book was intended to be about. And so I spent the whole more than 10 years thinking and observing and trying to characterize them, but also to characterize that relationship. There's always the danger that one will see them and think, isn't that cute? Bears are not cute. And they're rather frightening, in fact.
Now, where were you living when you would see all these animals up close?
We lived in Jonesville, which is part of Richmond, Vermont. And we lived about a mile and a half from the Winooski River and Route 2. So we were up, and we were up on a bluff quite high above the road, So we felt as if we were in a really private kind of woodland place, that we were at the edge of wilderness, because there's very little between that road and the next road over. It's all forest. And so we really were living in the territory of the animals and the birds. So that's why we saw so many of them. We lived at the base of a cliff, 100 some feet high, and that also added to that sense of, you know, the bobcats are up there.
Mm-hmm. Was there water on the property?
There was a small pond which we expanded, excavated, and I planted goldfish 1 year. I put goldfish in, and they grew to be a good size. And then one day, a mink, I'm sure it was a female, came and simply cleaned it out in one day. But there would be one visitation in the summer by heron, who would come to eat the frogs and the fish. The first day the frogs would come up, a pair of ducks of some sort would come. It wasn't always the same kind of duck. They would come and spend half a day and have breakfast.
That's fun. It's fun
so
to watch.
That's what it was like.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. The first two titles in this collection, the actual titles, resonate really nicely. You have Bull on the Roof and Sermon of the Wolf, both of which end with F. So I don't know. I wondered if that was on purpose. Were they designed to flow one into the other, or was that just something that you...
Well, in putting the collection together, I was mostly concerned about, because so many of the poems were seasonal, of having it sort of register as a kind of year-long whole. I tend, even though I've spent years and years trying to develop a sense of craft as a poet, I still write by ear. I mean, the sound of the language, the sounds of the words are very important to me, and so that may have had more to do with those being together than any logical reasons.
Okay. All right. I was wondering if we could start with your reading Bull on the Roof.
Sure.
And then we'll talk about it.
Bull on the Roof. These frogs saved the world. These frogs fornicating in the lonely pond, and these others singing all night in the trees. They saved the world for silence. All summer the rock cliff rises behind the woods in secret, looming behind birches and oak saplings, their murmuring shadows suggesting voices of soft-furred women in trees, their elegant tails draping the branches. These are images from a dream I want not to wake from, a dream where all the women's breasts freshen and I am the only child. High overhead, bursts of east light between stiff trunks thrust up from roots anchored in rock, penetrating the hidden places, as if winter lived in a small house there, next door to wind that blows only at night. Among these wet caves, there is nothing I'm afraid of, not the yellow-spotted salamander in the mud, not the mud, not the libidinous jack in the pulpit. I fold my clothes, unfold my body on a sun-drenched rock, and listen to the hairy woodpecker at work. One day when earth is exhausted with pushing up and weary of swallowing, when grouse tire of drumming, when the brown-headed cowbird has flown off with his bell and the nests are empty, when you and I are like animals of the forest, sated with heat, when leaves give way to the rain and weight of the sky, we will go indoors to wait for the snow. Winter will descend from its house. The cliff will move closer with icy teeth, huge in its power. We will turn our backs and sit close to the fire. We will hear the bull on the roof. We will dream bright meadows and running water.
Thank you for reading that. I thought that was such an amazing first poem to start this collection. It's got so much happening, and it's such a lovely introduction to the theme of nature, the the structural organization of the seasons, everything that's about to happen for the reader is in this poem a little bit. And also the way that you start talking about the fornication of the frogs, and then there's a lot of very sexual language in this poem, even though it's not necessarily overt. And I just loved it it's in so many ways. So I wondered what inspired this poem, if there was a certain inspiration, or if it was something you wrote toward the end of putting the collection together, or how this came to be.
It was one of the first of the poems, and I think my first big impression of the place was the tone of things. And at night, then when the tree frogs would begin their singing in the early spring, that was such an overpowering kind of, you know, this is where we are. We're in their place. Mm-hmm. So it was mostly that kind of tone setting that the land did for us and to us, rather than something that I tried to organize around it.
Which is probably a much better
frogs.
Way for it to come together.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Some have been baffled by the notion that there would be a bull in this wild place, and of course it's the metaphor of what the whole weather and climate and place are all this kind of not thing that struck me, having spent time at one stage of my life on a cattle ranch, as this kind of immensity, and so I wanted to characterize it, and that's how it seemed. Mm-hmm. It was this kind of thing that hovers,
yeah,
and moves and changes as the weather changes.
Right, a kind of implicit violence outside. Mm-hmm. But also the frogs can sort of be bulls too, I don't know,
bullfrogs. Bullfrogs, yes, right.
All right. Is this one that you read frequently when you go to readings for this book?
I do. In fact, there's one of the things that the publisher wanted us to do was to promote the book early on with videos. And there's a video on my Facebook page of me reading this. I feel like the fool on the hill, actually, more than the bull on the roof, because in the video I'm reading it on a hill in Shelburne Farms.
And, outdoors.
With
I think
the wind
I
blowing.
You know what? I saw that was a video. I didn't watch the video.
Right.
Okay, you're standing.
That's my
out.
Fool on the hill video. But it is beautiful. I mean, the landscape is gorgeous.
Yeah. Okay. Daniel, I wonder, how might a poem start for you? And you did talk a little bit about this particular poem and how it started for you, but is there a pattern to your creative approach at all, or does it always change?
I think something I discovered quite a long time ago was when I realized early on that I couldn't wait for things to happen to me to make poetry, because not very much happened in those early years, at least not anything that I was willing to write about. So for me, a poem begins in sentences, usually isolated sentences that are made while I'm reading or musing or wool gathering, as my mother would call it, early in the mornings, as is my practice. And then at the end of the week, or maybe the end of a month, I'll look at my notebook and see. Often I'll find that there's some thread been going on, and so I gather all the pieces that are related to that thread, and then poems come out of that. It's a synthetic process, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't start out to write a poem. I just find poems in this sort of in the process.
Well, that makes sense, because it sounds like that way your preoccupations and your sort of temporal, you know, thought process is going into the poem rather than purposefully mining something.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And also my interest for a long time, and this comes from my childhood, the interest in being able to sing. I wanted my poems to sing off the page. And so I don't know whether I succeed, but that's what drives the creation of a poem is song. Uh-huh. And that's why so often the titles will be phrases that sound like something wanting to happen.
You do have a reference in one of the poems, I think toward the end of the collection, about humming or singing under your breath.
Yes, right.
You refer to Ireland in some of your poems, including the second poem, Sermon of the Wolf. Your wife, Angela, is from Ireland.
Right.
Is this from her influence, or were you already interested in Ireland? Are you Irish of
only a little, not so that I would claim it.
Okay.
No, it's from that long association with her and learning, because the way that she uses language is very songful too. Uh-huh. But she's also the person who introduced me to Irish folk tales, and this collection is very much informed by folklore of all sorts
and fairy tales the next poem I was going to ask you to read actually is Seasonal with Goats, which has some fairy tale to it. I wonder if we could do that now.
Sure.
Okay, great.
Seasonal with Goats. The bull again. In spring, wood women set out flowers, trillium, anemone, to lure him up the rock again. Where he passes, jacks in the pulpit grow. Snow melt, and we grow closer to the rind of the world. Mm-hmm. Remember now the brothers Gruff. I love that troll. He lived just under all my fears. I heard him coughing in the dark, so familiar he should have had a name. I'm looking for the big beast when the little beast comes. Some still believe a crust of bread might be holy. Let this sacred porridge represent the promise in the world for the return of equilibrium. What could the women want more than a little salt and sweet water at the close of a bitter season?
Hmm. Thank you. Love that one. I love the porridge as a sacred promise.
We have a sort of family joke because Angela and I are vegetarians. The wonderful story of the salmon of knowledge, which comes from Irish folklore and history. Angela's brother and I would get together when I visited in Ireland, and he would always make porridge in the morning, and I referred to it as the porridge of knowledge, because being a vegetarian, we didn't eat meat. So
that's funny. So the bull again, the first line of Seasonal with Goats. I wondered if you can talk a little bit. You said that you will notice a thread running through your notes as you write down sentences, but there are threads that run through this whole collection. There are repeating themes and images. Mm-hmm. The bull, also salamanders and caves, a lot of references to mud and mud people. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that comes into the play of the whole?
Well, I think it's part of my not becoming a Vermonter, or even calling myself a Vermonter, until we moved to the woods and we began to experience mud season, which you know, as Vermonters know, is you know, endemic to our living here. But you know, the road and the sense of what makes that sort of bridge between winter and spring. And so for me, it became almost, it took on a sort of mythic proportion for me, because it was something to be dealt with always. But it also seemed to me that was the primal stuff. It was what made things possible in the way that we lived and where we lived. So that's why it became part of almost a fairy tale element of the poems. Mm-hmm. And to recall the bull, that was just me, you know, making those the easy associations first, and then seeing what would happen if I brought them along.
Okay. Does this happen for you in other collections with other threads? I know you have a collection that I was going to ask you about later, about the lake, lake studies, meditations on Lake Champlain. Mm-hmm. So will there be threads of, I'm assuming the bull doesn't show up in lake studies.
No. Actually, I had, I wrote the, this whole collection and my living in the woods came before the lake book, even though the most recent published.
Okay.
This collection circulated for a long time in various guises before it was picked up by Windridge. But that book was in, the Lake Studies book was intentionally written with out of research, out of 2 years of research and actually intentionally making a book about Lake Champlain. Mm-hmm. So this all simply came together as a result of where I lived.
Okay, all right. Let's talk a little bit about the organizing principle behind Kin. You have four sections, seasonal sections, I presume is how you were
more or less
seeing it. So were you the person who organized this, or did you work with your editor to organize the book?
No, I did the organization, and Lynn Stone at Windridge, we talked a lot about why I'd done it the way I did, but ultimately she liked the way it was put together, mm-hmm. so it went forward that way.
Mm-hmm. This is trivial, but I love the typeface, and I love that each poem begins with this beautiful letter. So where did that come from?
Windridge has its own designer, and when I first saw the first design proofs of this book with the cover and then the typeface and the and that sort of an allusion to illuminated manuscripts, I was stunned. I mean, I just thought this is such a beautiful book.
It is. Yeah. And you're
she
right.
Just got it right.
The title on the cover has those same treatments for the letters.
Right. It was also my sense that, it does make sense to other people that a book about the natural environment, the natural world, and animals and whatnot can allude for other people to, it can have associations for other people to older poetry and to older things and to myth and and sort of that it reinforces everything I was trying to do in the poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really lovely presentation, the whole book. I was curious, when I'm working on something, I suddenly see it in everything. I was wondering if there was a point in writing and actively gathering these poems into a book that you began to notice nature even more closely, or is that just something that's sort of always how you are in the natural world? You know, did you end up having a heightened awareness for a period of time while you were working on these?
Yes, the process of sitting every morning, either by the fire if it was winter, or on the deck where I could observe where I was and feel where I was. That sense that came that became the poems was part of my learning to be there, because I wasn't on vacation. Mm-hmm. I was plowing the 700-foot driveway myself. I was splitting the wood with a maul, you know, doing the physical work of being there. I was learning how to be in such a place because I'd never been in such a place before. I'd done physical work before, but I'd never done that kind of work before. Mm. So it was all of a piece, and the poems were kind of the cream off the top of that experience of learning to live there. Mm-hmm. So and the animals were part of that. How do you live with animals that will destroy your gardens if you're not, you know? And how much do you just stop worrying about it?
Yeah.
How much do you feed the birds when you know the bears are going to come and bend down the feeder for you?
Right. Now I'm trying to remember if there are chopping wood poems. You're not doing the David Budbill poetry.
No, but there's reference to, there's at least one poem where I'm carrying the wood in from the woodshed and I disturb the nest of a mouse again.
Okay.
Which seemed to happen every time I went for wood. There was always, at another level, there was another mouse nest. So there is that. Yeah, in the woodpile.
Yeah, okay. I wonder if you would read another one now.
Sure.
You have a poem called Boat Pond Girl.
This poem, Boat Pond Girl, has the literal objects of the life that was in front of me all the time. There was the pond, obviously. But there was a boat that had been sort of left there by the previous owner. It was a handmade boat. It was never intended to be on water. It was a kind of an ornament to the pond. And so that's where some of this comes from.
Okay.
There's also an insect. As I lived there, I was trying to figure out, you know, what are these creatures in the water? And there was a bug that seemed to be like a beetle, but it only had two legs. And it ate things like the early stages of the frogs, the polywogs.
Okay.
So that's all in here. And also we inherited an 8-foot satellite dish, which soon was not functional because a tree fell on it. So that's all in here. Boat Pond Girl. This boat beside the pond is not seaworthy. This pond is not a worthy sea for going off in boats or deep imagining. It keeps the little fish, green frogs, and yellow-spotted salamanders in mud tunnels underneath the boat. The carnivorous two-oared bug without a name who eats the polywogs. Rain runs in. A blue Buddha watches over. Here is a moss bank with a copse of trees and a moss-covered path leading away through the woods toward habitations of grouse and hare. If this is the world navel, how shall we think of this old satellite dish aimed at the ridge of mountains to the west and no longer connected to anything? I will think of it as the chakra of this place and one day glimpse eternity. Imagine the goldfish, debonair, rising with their gold-headed canes and strolling out among the trees, singing a tune you can almost remember hearing before. I have a stick with a knob on the end. Naked, I have stones in my pocket. If I tap my stick on the ground, is there a bush god who will answer, or a green girl to wave from the boat?
Thank you. Then it's so funny because I was going to talk again about the fairy tale being just below the surface of this poem, but now that you've explained some of these references, I don't know that I think that so much anymore. Maybe a little bit.
What was that?
I think it was the green girl to wave from the boat. I don't know. I'm imagining mermaids or something.
Well, you're not wrong. I mean, the fact that I kept moving, especially in this poem, it's evident, back and forth between what's obvious there in front of me and imaginings.
Yes.
You know, the goldfish rising out of the pond to walk.
With their canes.
Among the trees. Right, right. So, I mean, it's all kind of that combination of the... and the Buddha actually was a little statue that I kept painting every year until it became mostly paint, was sitting among the ferns. So it's all in there, but it's also all me just transforming it.
Yeah, okay. I know you teach... You teach at UVM. You also sometimes will teach the occasional class at the Writer's Barn.
Right. And most I've retired officially from UVM from teaching.
Oh, you did?
A couple of years ago.
Okay.
And so, it was a great thing to have happened because now I can spend time doing the community workshops that I like to do, which mm-hmm. I didn't have time to do before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The writing community in this area has become so rich and available, and there's so many options now for people to take classes. It's really fun. I used to teach occasionally at certain rec departments, you know, and I'd mm-hmm. make a suggestion for a class, but they may or may not have a writing class in any given season, and now there are just lots of options.
Right,
it's really
right.
fun. Well, I was going to ask you about your schedule, your writer's schedule with the teaching, but it sounds like maybe your writer's schedule has opened up a little bit.
It has, yeah. A lot, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What's the meaning of Carreg Binn, and I may be saying that wrong?
Carreg Binn is an Irish phrase, term, which means sweet rock.
Okay.
And we named our place for that at the suggestion of Angela's brother, actually, because of the cliff. And So it sounded right. Also, Bin gives, there's another sort of, if you were translating, it might also mean sweet music.
Okay.
So it seemed like the right thing to call the place where we live.
And that's your website as well.
Right.
Yeah, and I noticed that you still have the sign out even though you're not living right in front of the cliff anymore.
Now it's a virtual place.
Well, would you mind reading Now Playing at Carrick Bin?
Oh, not at all. We had wonderful neighbors in our place, and the neighbors directly across the street, whose roof we could see in the winter when the leaves were down. They had a young son who is now a professional jazz musician. And when he was first learning to play the trumpet, he would practice outside.
Oh, cool.
In the summer. So we heard him grow into this wonderful trumpet player. And so that's where this poem actually came from.
All right.
Now playing at Carrick Bin. A brand new horn cannot account for the sudden brilliance of trills that May afternoon. Spring opens its arms, and the kid across the way emerges to practice his trumpet outdoors. He's tuning his embouchure over the swamp, soprano sacks of termagant geese honking their teenaged goslings to flight. Who knows if the cow moose refrains from yelling because her mouth dangles marsh marigold blossoms. I'm hanging ripe store-bought grapes from the deck to entice the northern oriole high in a red oak on the bluff, blowing a melodious cover of yellow-bellied sapsuckers' snare drum licks on the shed roof tin. Meantime, it's clear that a frog by our pond unearthed a new riff during the winter sabbatical, the old shape notes plus a devilish trill. At 13, I resolved in my dreams the baffling plié of the swimmer's side stroke, the hurdler's cockeyed grand jeté. Having lost a front tooth, doing something less tricky, today I'm relearning to whistle.
Right. I love that one. I particularly love knowing the background to it. how was it at the beginning when he started playing? Was it a little bit rough?
Well, I had tried to learn to play the trumpet as a child, so I knew what he was going through.
That's funny.
But he progressed very quickly.
I mentioned a little bit ago your book, Lake Studies, Meditations on Lake Champlain, and it has a companion audiobook on CD called The Inland Sea. So how did that come about? I'm curious about the packaged set or how those two things came together.
Well, after all of the research that I mentioned earlier, the 2 years of research that yielded that book, I began, of course, like now, to do readings from the book. And friends and also the publisher, the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum, suggested that I do something with the readings, with the sound. And so I proposed to them that we do a CD that could be an additional collection. But my real thought was, at about that time, my older brother died in hospice in Phoenix, and I was not there at the very last when he was unable to talk. And I thought, if only he'd had, well, what he wanted was my younger brother, who was there, and his daughter, to read poems from Angela's book and mine to him while he was in hospice. And I thought, if only he'd had a CD of my work, he could have listened to it, you know, without having to have someone read to him. And so so we did the recording, and they published it as a beautiful package CD. I recorded it with a musician named Michael Chorney, who lives in Lincoln, and is a wonderful local musician and songwriter. I recorded it in his house, and so it was professionally done and all that.
He has a studio.
Yes.
In his home. No, so did he play music on the CD as well? I'm sorry, I haven't heard the CD. So Is it you reading poems or?
No, it's me reading poems, and it has an introduction with some music from a CD called Lake Studies by Lar Duggan, who's also a local jazz musician and composer. And his music had been part of how I thought about and how I presented the early poems. Mm-hmm. When I would go do a reading, I would play Lar's music with a video that I had from the Maritime Museum, underwater mm-hmm. Footage. And so it was sort of natural to take some phrases from his music as an introduction. And then there's another place where there's a break in the CD where there's some more music.
Mm-hmm. Now that I know what Carrigbin means, I'm wondering if Sweet Rock Amen came from that association too. Did you say Carrig means sweet rock? Or
Carrig is rock.
Rock.
And Bin is sweet.
Okay. So the poem Sweet Rock Amen, is that also a reference to home and that same?
That poem may have been written before we moved to the country.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember.
Would you mind reading that?
Sure. This poem was actually prompted by an article in the paper about a flood in Africa.
Mm.
And a woman who had climbed into a tree, a pregnant woman had climbed into a tree, and there was a photograph of her in the newspaper, and she gave birth in the tree.
Oh my goodness.
And then was rescued by a helicopter holding this infant that was absolutely newborn. And I was so stunned by the image and by the story that this poem came from that.
Okay.
It just happens to be Sweet Rock.
Okay. I didn't mean to ask a stumper.
It's great. And that's why the little epigraph at the bottom for them, Sophia and daughter Rosita, I was able, thanks to Google, to find the names of those of the woman and her daughter.
So
Sweet Rock Amen. How is it the woman climbed into this tree from the floodwaters swirling below and gave birth to her child? Sweet rock, amen. Good God of the tree, good God of the helicopter come down from the sky, good ordinary God who replies only to the question put to him. Sweet rock, amen. Hearing such news from the radio, I stand in my kitchen watching a barred owl watching a pan of fish I left on the field stone wall. Fierce God standing still in a tree, blinking out from your mask of white bone. Wind loves those feathers. Whisper of death today, a rumor in the woods. Sweet rock, amen. The world is as large as my prayers. The God is as small, and all my questions are trivial. I am awestruck by ordinary things.
Mm, wonderful.
Now that I read the poem, I remember that I did write this poem.
From that home.
From Carrigbin, yeah.
But maybe the Sweet Rock Amen had more to do with...
The story was not contemporary. It was an older story that I had remembered and was fascinated by. And I actually had clipped out the picture of the woman, and it was in my notebook someplace. And so it was one of those things that I would do in the same way that memory would often inform something, a new poem, where the memory was from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that some people have noticed is the occurrence of the word holy in this book and the kind of reverence, the sense of reverence. And when I was a young man, I was intended for the ministry.
Mm.
And I was raised with, in a very religious home. And even though all of that, over a period of many, many years, fell away from me, the church and religion, the language of religion stayed with me and is part of what informs the way I think about what poems are. Sometimes they're prayers and sometimes they're But they don't have anything to do with religion, really. They have to do with what we really, our natural impulse to speak from the heart, mm-hmm. or to wish that there were something that could we could make happen by thinking would make it so.
Yeah.
So that's why this language in this poem. I wouldn't mention that otherwise, but that's why.
Well, and it's interesting because the refrain is very reminiscent of a prayer, and of a song, and it doesn't feel like you're speaking to a certain God, but it does feel spiritual.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Let's see. I always ask a question for my listeners who might be writers, some advice. And in your case, I was going to ask if you have advice for aspiring nature poets or lovers of the natural world who might feel intimidated to write about it or sort of inadequate to the task. I've met many people who always, you know, refer to nature writing as being different than any other kind of writing because it's overwhelming. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Or do you have any advice?
I guess I can only speak for my approach, and because I've always loved being accurate about what I say about whatever it is, and almost always as a nature reference. So I do my homework, and often the facts will suggest ways of dealing with the natural world. But also, almost all of my poems have come from firsthand experience. I want to know to understand something about the world that I'm writing about. So it's not. I think if we romanticize nature and write about it in a sort of generic way, that's the danger part, mm-hmm. because it's so easy to speak as if nature were always the same and always sort of, you know, we all know what nature is.
Mm-hmm.
The best nature poetry comes from direct experience of nature. So a walk in the woods is way more important than, you know, hours spent ruminating. Wordsworth did a great job with nature writing, but he walked. He wasn't pretending. And
Thoreau?
And Thoreau's prose is all poetry to me, but it was all from direct experience.
Yeah.
So there's that. But once you've sort of had sort of the sense that if you want to go beyond that direct experience, then do some homework.
Mm-hmm. Look up the two-legged bug.
Right, which I did.
Okay, great. That's good advice. I was going to ask you to finish with one last poem, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
And we're nearing winter solstice, so I wonder if you might read The Bear's Carol.
Sure. Winter solstice. Clink of glasses, far-off songs. We're warm here, where snow ticks down on hemlocks, repeats and repeats, as if it were news and we didn't believe it. Having sung those fat months to her brawling triplets as she browsed witch hazel leaves, foraging for butternuts and thimbleberries, grubbing larvae from the rotted stump by our stony wall, now Bear sleeps in a secret crevice on the hill. What was the bear's carol about then? About her own hairy god, her own child born in a cave, her descent into dark and the miracle. South wind today sings of magnolias, catfish, jambalaya, wild turkeys by the road in bright spring attire, old-fashioned girls with red ribbons sewn into their brown petticoats. Bear dreams a faint rumor of light to come.
Thank you so much for reading that.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. It was really fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview from the archives with Vermont poet Daniel Lusk. You can learn more about his work and that of his wife, the poet and prose writer Angela Patton, at carrigbinn.com, which is spelled CARRAIGBINN.com. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from another local writer who's also a visual artist. Lily Henriksen lives in Bristol, Vermont. I actually invited her on the show because she has a relatively new chapbook of poems that she's put out, but she prefers not to come on the show. I think she's a little bit shy that way, but she did offer us a wonderful writing prompt. If you go to her website, lilyhenriksen.com, you'll see a lot of her works of art there. You can choose one and write an ekphrastic poem. And then if you share it with Lily, or if you share it with me and I share it with Lily, she might put it on her website next to the work of art that you chose to write about. Ekphrastic comes from the Greek word for description, and the Poetry Foundation describes an ekphrastic poem as one that's a vivid description of a scene, or more commonly, a work of art, through the imaginative act of narrating and reflecting on the action of a painting or sculpture, the poet may amplify and expand its meaning. So my suggestion is that you visit Lily's website, take a look at the art there, and write. If you choose to share the outcome, you'll probably find Lily's contact information on her website, or you can share it with me, and I will pass it along to her. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. As I go into stores in and around Chittenden County, I'm noticing fewer masks and a lot of signs up on doors saying, you know, if you're fully vaccinated, please come in without a mask. And if you're not fully vaccinated, please come in wearing a mask. Vermont is a little ahead of the curve as far as being vaccinated and opening up more. So that's exciting for Vermonters. And I hope that if you're in another state, things are working in that direction for you as well. In the meantime, of course, authors are still bringing out their books, trying to launch them in areas that may or may not have the opportunity to stand in a physical space with other people. And so there are still a lot of virtual book tours that are going on out there. So I hope that you're able to find those books, find the works by people who you follow, find new works that you will enjoy, and try to support authors by following their in-person or virtual book tours. Keep in mind, if you're a writer, that the archives of Write the Book offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. So if you go to the podcast site, you will see those writing prompts. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. I'm going through a little bit of a transition. We're moving into a slightly different format. So as you listen, let me know if you like the changes. Let me know if there are certain interviews you'd like me to try to do with certain authors, or if you have events to announce. If you like Write the Book, please rate it wherever you find it. Like it on Facebook, tweet about it, talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. And you can also find us, as I say every week, on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Pandora, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.